Yeah, so I'm just going to talk for about 20 minutes. In a way, just drawing your attention to one particular aspect of the system of practice, which I think is, interesting. Like, they're all interesting, of course. So we've got integration, cultivating awareness, mindfulness of breathing, classically, body awareness. Positive intention, people play about with what they call that positive emotion, positive intention, karmic volition, whatever you want, that's classically associated with metta bhava. Dharmic receptivity, sometimes something else that happens, and you'll see the study material, people change the order around a bit, so sometimes dharmic receptivity is third, sometimes it's fifth. Personally, I think it works better in third, and it seems like that's what Truvatna's defaulting to. It's a bit early to say. So dharmic receptivity, classically just sitting, but just allowing space to unfold. Kama Dana runs, what do you call them? Do nothing days or something like that.
That's what it says on the tin.
That's what it says on the tin, exploring dharmic receptivity, allowing opening space. Spiritual death, letting go, seeing through, classically associated with six elements. Spiritual rebirth, something new arising, associated with faith, sadhana, classically. So one of the defining changes that's happened in the last 5 years is that classically Truvatna's rolled with, for the first X years of your Dharma life, quite a substantial number. Basically you're working on integration and positive emotion, and we sort of effectively didn't even mention anything further up that chain from that. It's just, you just need to get on with that. With initiation into a new life, you could argue it's quite a substantial paper. One of the key points of it is suggesting that we need to include all of these stages earlier and more fully in people's lives, in people's dharmic lives. So in a sense, that's what we're exploring today, or this morning. How can we do that? How are these elements more present in your life? I'm going to talk a bit about spiritual death because it's one of the areas I'm interested in. And I think it's, as with anything, it's an area where it's, in a way, to just like draw out this point that these stages have been classically associated with specific meditation practices. And what we're trying to do is see that that is to limit them, it started off as the system of meditation, and in the system of meditation you did six element practice, and what we're trying to do is we're trying to say, no, it's bigger than that, it's a principle. Truvatna is all about principles. So what is the principle, and what does that look like in our personal lives? So you could apply that to any of them, but as I say, spiritual death is the one which I suppose I'm interested in, have something to say about. So you don't have to talk about it, but it's just as a way of illustrating the point. So spiritual death, like I remember doing this with you a couple of years ago, and sort of like, this word of, the use of the word death, or in a way it's deliberately provocative, isn't it? We die, we let go, things change. So it's, in a way, spiritual death is all about recognising the inevitability of a process of change, and allowing that, in a way, inviting, spiritual death is specifically, it's about inviting change to affect us. So how do we do that? What ways do we do that? I just want to talk about two specific ways in which we can do that, much more broadly than just by associating it specifically with meditation and reflection on Vilakshanas or reflection on six elements or whatever. So the first one, I think, is what are we inviting change? Like, forgive me if this seems obvious to you, but in a way it's a starting point for conversation and exploration. Where do we change? What needs to change? Where can change occur? So one of the key aspects of our being, one of the key kind of building blocks of our being, is our views. Like, was visiting Subhuti a month ago, and he was just reiterating the central significance of our views and how they shape our experience of being alive. That they are what, you know, you could even go as far to say as they are what we are. Just to illustrate that, to kind of unfold it, if you're thinking, what are you talking about? I remember having a very, very striking experience, I don't know, like it must be at least 12 years ago now, where I was, I just had, you know, one of those moments when you kind of like, you see what you're like, you know, like I had one of those moments, I saw what I was like. And I remember turning to a friend and I was saying to him, I can more imagine losing my right arm than I can imagine not having a habitual tendency towards anxiety. Yeah, I like, you know, like if, you know, like I lost my right arm, it's like, sure, that, you know, like I'm right-handed, that would suck, you know, that would be difficult, but you know, my sense of identity would reconcile that relatively quickly, whereas the sort of you know, the pervasive psychic tendency to relate to the world on a slightly anxious basis, yeah, that's me. Do you know what I mean? Like, that is me. If I didn't do that, I wouldn't be me. I'd be decisively different. So that's, in a way, that, you know, just getting, you know, and that tendency to anxiety, that is a view. You know, views are fundamentally emotional attitudes through which we process our experience. Yeah, they're emotional attitudes through which we process our experience. Sure, they get worked up into, they kind of views. They kind of, there's like the, you know, the they kind of, they get more and more specific, more and more explicit. So, you know, like the view that I think, you know, so-and-so political party is better than that party. I'm disappointed about this or that. I think people should be like this. Those are all kind of specific expressions, yeah? But they kind of, they're all kind of rooting down into these much kind of deeper, bigger substrate kind of attitudes to life. And that's what views are, you know. The Buddhist tradition identifies the kind of like, you know, the root views, the Sakkaya Drishti, like, which is these kind of like these very kind of like deep principial things. It's like, you know, the attitude to self-identity, the attitude to self-clinging, that's what we're trying to get down to. So anyway, so yeah, we've got these views. And what can we do about it? How can we address these tendencies to construct and interpret our experience? These like emotional, psychic, intellectual tendencies. So I'm just going to say something about two key ways that we can all do that all the time, or much more immediately, much more effectively. The first one is study. Yeah. So the purpose of study in the Buddhist tradition is to clarify, to understand how we see the world and work out whether that is a helpful way of seeing it, and work out whether the Buddha might have a better suggestion of how you might look at things, and that might actually make life go better for you and for other people. So I think it's just, in a way, I suppose it's one of those things where, you know, study, reflection, kind of like, you know, Dhammakatha, talking the Dharma. I think it's interesting that in this model, that never gets mentioned or it easily gets sidelined as a central way in which we're doing this. Spiritual death is about seeing through our wrong misconceptions about the way the world works, and the central importance of coming into contact with the Buddha's teaching and seeing how that applies to our lives. So yeah, so in a way it's just really holding up the practice of study as a value. How you actually do that in the moment, of course, is a much more nuanced beast. It's like, how do we, in a way you could spend a whole day talking about that, how do you move from sort of sitting around in a group kind of batting around Buddhist ideas to actually that being a moment of spiritual death, you know. That I think is very, very interesting. And I'm not, in a way, I don't even quite know for myself how I do that. I suppose there's a couple of things, isn't there? But probably the most important thing is just a practice of being, of honesty, you know, being really honest about what we think and feel and bringing that to the table. And within that, of course, there's two interesting dimensions. There's the dimension of being honest about when we, you know, disagree and don't think, oh, I don't agree with that. But it's also being honest about, like, letting our inspiration fly. That's where this whole model kind of ties into each other, because actually studying the Dharma can be a spiritual rebirth just as much, you know, like reading the word for Buddha and just feeling uplifted and taken into another world. That's much more, you know, like death and rebirth kind of come hand in hand. You let go of something, something new arises. So yeah, so like in a sense, allowing ourselves to be inspired is a shift from spiritual death to spiritual rebirth. It's important to emphasise how these all tie together. You could say the other way that, like I'm temperamentally sort of relationally orientated in a quite strong way, I would say. That's how I experience myself. So some of the ways in which I experience spiritual death in study groups is, like, I remember a decisive point. Many of you will have had this point where you recognise what you're like in a group and you start working on that in the group experience. So I would say my first 3 years of being in study groups, I consistently certainly said more than all the other kind of participants, and often said more than the person who was leading the group. You know, I have kind of gone back and asked my friends who were leading those groups what that was like, but you know, I talked a lot. and at a certain point, you have to recognise that you're doing that and do something about it. So I had this practice of only speaking only saying something if I felt like it was directly challenging my self-identity. Because I just, you know, what you've all sat in groups of people who talk too much. And you've probably all independently are recognised that they're doing that because they're a bit nervous and they're seeking to assert their self-identity, and that's how they do it. Completely human. But it's like, yeah, recognising that and working with that directly. And I think then the other thing is, it's just this thing of trying to be really, in a way what we're trying to do when we're studying the Dharma is we're trying to actually let it in. Yeah, so it's like really let it in. So one of the key ways of doing that is allowing the discomfort to arise, allowing the discrepancy between how we lead our lives and the implications of what the Buddha's saying. Don't, you know, not batting that off, not dismissing it, not undercutting it, not coming up with smart arguments to explain why it's not true and it doesn't apply to us, but just like let it hit you. Yeah. So again, I was I had a number of very tangible moments of this when I was with Subhuti last month, and you know, he was saying things, presenting the Dharma, presenting the lived Dharma. You know, he was talking about how we practice our Dharma lives. How he was with a bunch of friends, relatively junior order members, and he was talking about how to relate to the order, and I could just feel this kind of like, you know, like the challenge in what he was saying, for kind of like, the, you know, take this seriously, live this Dharma life wholeheartedly. And the, I'm like, oh God, I don't want to hear that, because that means something about how I live my life. So the challenge of spiritual death, the reason why it's a death is because you let it hit you. You're like, oh, come on. And my life would be better if I did those things. It's not like that's, he's not cutting me up, he's not doing anything bad to me, he's saying live more fully. It's this really important thing to understand for spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. It's like it's saying, you know, like this kind of like the hard shell of our beings, it's safe but it's constricting and it's painful. Stop it as much as you're able to. But still, you're still, it's like in the moment, you're like, oh, I don't want to hear that, I just want to have a nice, easy life. Stop it. So that's one key area in which we can just, in a way, like we're all doing that, we're all engaging with the Dharma, we're all in just like let it in more fully. The other area, I apologise for this, both of these being sort of discomfort orientated, although they can lead, they directly lead to inspiration. The other sort of central area is how we relate to other human beings. Yeah. So the capacity for spiritual death in those moments when basically people do things we don't like and how we respond to it. People, the stories we have about ourselves and the centrality of our experience and how other people consistently impinge inflict, invade our way, the way we think the world should be, and how we deal with that experience. If again, there's such a rich area of opportunity. In a way, it's this something that really struck me a few years ago, addressing what the wrong views in the world. It was doing a study on the transcendental principle, and Dharmadipa said one of the core wrong views is that thinking that things happen for a reason. Things don't happen for a reason. Things just happen. Once they've happened, you've then got a choice how you respond to that. So he was particularly talking about this view that life sends us lessons. Life doesn't send us lessons. It just sucks sometimes. You know, getting cancer is not a lesson from life. It sucks. How you can choose to learn a lesson from it, but that is different. Yeah, you can choose to learn a lesson from life, but life is not sending you a lesson. Yeah, it's really important to understand, because otherwise you end up with the problem of God, and why does God let bad things happen? Well, there is no God, and bad things happen because that's what it's like being in conditioned existence. But then we've got a choice of how we respond. And that obviously ties into how we respond to the people in our worlds. And it's not just people being difficult, it's all these moments of interaction. What do we do with that? And this is where, again, this is obvious, but like this is where we can, if we want to be free, then we need to apply energy, we need to apply effort. Like realistically, most of us are not going to kind of meditate for long enough or consistently enough to do the job that you need to do. So actually you need to find ways of applying these principles to your daily lives, because actually we're living our life all the time, and if you want to see the true nature of reality, you need to put in the time. So to give you a couple of examples of that, I had a perfect one on Thursday. It's quite interesting. I was sitting chatting to one of the guys at the Buddhist Centre. It was at the Buddhist during a public class. He's been around for ages. He was made a mitra before I was, and we were just chatting away, kind of hanging out. We haven't seen each other for a bit. This guy kind of sitting next to us, very new guy, kind of leans over. He'd been in the class with the guy I was talking to, and he said, "What does this mean?" They had a handout, it was from Nyanaketu's group, and he was looking at the word klesha. He said, "What does this mean?" So he was asking my friend, so I was like, "Go for it." And he's like, "No, you say it." So I said something. I thought I did a reasonably good job. And then, so it's got like, baff, there you go, mate. That's what the kleshas are. Doof. Kind of turned back to my conversation. And he just said to me, "God, I've forgotten how good you are at that." So that was great, and I'm like, and it's like I can just feel myself going, aren't I good? And what's interesting, because he's into this, he's like, "Don't do that, what are you doing?" And it's like, just these moments where you know, we create self-identity. So I was like going, "Oh, look at me, aren't I good and clever, and don't I explain Buddhist ideas very well?" It's like, oh yeah. So it's good that I think I am pretty good at being clear and giving people clear examples to help them understand the Dharma. But then it's sort of like, in a way, it's like what we do with that, how we kind of take that and kind of stick it into us and go, "Oh, you know, that makes me, and that makes me feel okay and good about myself." So that's one example. The other example, for more immediate, like in a sense, for more tangible one, is that thing of when people do things we don't like and how we respond to that, and how we, how we tell a story about ourselves, about them, about what the world's like. Just really recognising all of that. Again, I had quite a tangible experience of that last week where I'd not done something very well. Yeah, like I'd, you know, like a whole series of reasons. Anyway, I was in a situation, I've just done something not very well and somebody else didn't like it. It's like, fair enough, yeah, I didn't do that very well. But what was really interesting is the extent to which, you know, I felt like I did a reasonably good job of working with this, but the extent to which I can feel myself wanting to go into, it's their fault. You know, it's like, okay, yeah, I didn't do that very well, but you could have noticed, you could have asked me questions before this and not got to the point where you're saying, yeah, I didn't do that very well. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was an organisational thing. I hadn't told them something, and then right at the last minute, they're like, "What's happening?" And I told them and they didn't like it. And it's like, well, yeah, but you... it's like I should have told them that like a week ago, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, a month ago. But equally, they could have asked me what was going on, because it's both our responsibilities. And just watching the tendency in my mind to be like, why didn't you ask me? You should have asked me earlier. It's your fault. It's not my fault. And like I say, I felt like I did a reasonably good job of thinking, you know, like it's like, yeah, this isn't all my fault, actually. And I have, you know, I have just been moving, and that means I've been quite busy and had quite a lot on my plate. And actually, you could have asked me earlier. But, you know, like, it's one of those things where, in a way, this point of spiritual death, it's like, it's like, it's not holding on to the story. It's kind of like, it's just letting what happened. So it's like, okay, yeah, he could have asked me earlier, but he didn't. And that's okay. I could have been more organised, but I wasn't. That doesn't mean to say I'm a terrible person. Yeah? So in a way, I felt like I did a reasonably good job of not getting, you know, when you get enmeshed in, he did this and I'm like that, and that's... Blah, blah, blah. It's just like letting that all be a lot looser, a lot more flowing. So yeah, so that's... In a way, that's, like I say, I just wanted to say a bit to kind of get us going, and then we'll kind of go into it, because otherwise it's me talking all the time. So the point I'm trying to raise, or what I've just been trying to communicate, is I've just been using spiritual death as an example of how to lead effective dharmic lives, we need to find ways in which these principles are alive and present in our lives. So it's like, don't just, you know, like, integration isn't just about doing for mindfulness of breathing every other day for half an hour, that's it, job done. It's like, okay, how am I integrating myself in my life? How is that an alive principle in my experience? Positive emotion, receptivity, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth. How can we make them more alive? I suppose, and just to end, again, referring back to Sabiti, that And this is a temperamental thing, so it's fine. I remember having a, in a way, a similar conversation with him quite a few years ago, and I was saying to him, like, I was having, you know, like, it's one of those kind of, I was having one of those moments, I was like, it's, you know, it's so hard to clearly see the true nature of reality, you know, like, you know, you can use both metaphors, it's immediate and it's hard, you know, both are true, but I was saying, God, it's so hard, like, how am I ever going to do that? If through meditation, you know, I was just like, I was unconvinced, like, you know, like, it's like, you know, like, I don't meditate for an hour a day, like, half an hour, 40 minutes, it's like, you know, sometimes I do an hour and a half if you count my teaching, you know, teaching things, it's like, really, in an hour and a half a day, I'm going to realise the true nature of reality, I'm just not convinced. And I was sort of saying this to him, and I was sort of like, what do you do? And I was saying to him, it's like, what you need is energy, what you need is momentum. And so I was saying to him, so how do we get that? And he said, effectively, what I've just been saying, you get that momentum by applying the Dharma to your life, to your interactions, to, you know, the moment-by-moment experience of your day. Because then, if you do that consistently, that is a context to get enough momentum to actually get somewhere.